or what would make a light bulb. And by the way, he didn't do it on his own. He had a great big staff of people who were helping him. He was doing forensic engineering. Step by step, he was finding out what worked and what didn't work. Somewhere in the middle of the process, somebody asked him, hey, Alva, how's it going? Let me drop. And he said, it's going pretty well. I know 3,000 things that don't work. And he eventually found a solution to the problem. The real engineering world is like that. There's this fits and stops and stops and whatever, successes and failures. And if you're smart, the failures are a learning process. You find out what doesn't work and you find out what to do instead. As long as it's not destructive and as long as nobody dies in the process, it's perfectly all right to occasionally make mistakes. That's the real world. There are some very complimentary people who will periodically say that, gee, these guys, Mel and Dick, my goodness, do they have a whole lot of smarts. They must be geniuses. I got a solution for you. I got a piece of information for you. They're not geniuses. They're just people who have simply been exposed to this for a long period of time, and they've had the interest. Mel has probably spent about 35 years in the engineering world. Dick has spent about 35 years in the engineering world. So you're hearing the result of 70 years of exposure to this material. And in that exposure, we've discovered that a heck of a lot of the times, we come up with sincere solutions that happen to be wrong. Nobody passed 1,000. That's the real world. There are people in engineering schools in New Jersey and New York who will suggest to their students, they listen to the technical net in order to get some exposure to what wireless engineering is like. And real wireless engineering has occasional mistakes and discussions and arguments as to what's the best way to solve a particular problem. For those who are disappointed by the fact that their favorite subject is not being discussed, let me drop. We're not forcing you to listen to the subject. We're not forcing you to listen to this particular channel. For those who feel that the discussions go on for too long, yes, it does. And you know the question I've quite often asked people, should we be more brief or be thorough? And quite often the answer comes back, please be more brief, except when you get to my subject, please give me the whole answer. I want to know everything that's going on. So there's also people who will say, gee, I can't stay up that late at night. Can't you get to the good stuff in the beginning and get to these discussions later on? Well, there's a simple solution to that one. Run your tape recorder, and while you're driving to work or while you're on the train, listen to the tape recording the next day. And if you don't want to run the tape recorder, each Sunday night, the material is completely being recorded, and by about Wednesday or Thursday, Mike, KC2NJI, will put it on his website, www.amateurradio.tangovictor. You go there and you can listen to it. And if you wait another week or two before it gets documented, you can then listen to the recording, zip through the stuff you don't want to listen to, very similar to what people do when they record a television program. By listening to the recording, they zip through the advertisements and get to the good stuff, so to speak. And you have the option of doing that. So as you can see, Mel, I'm pretty sure, feels this way, and I know I feel this way. Useful information in the real engineering process, you are being exposed to that when you listen to those guys discussing how to go to the next step of doing the troubleshooting. So from my point of view, that is the meat of what the technical net does. We show you how to do troubleshooting. And it doesn't have to be 100% accurate all the time. That's not the real world. I think you see my philosophy on this one. Let me drop. Okay, as long as you're willing to suffer the long-windedness of K2RIW, an occasional slightly more brief solution from K2KEY, then please do sign into the TechNet, giving us your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Please do so at this time. K2RIW listening.
November to X-ray, Juliet, November. Wesley, yes.
S-Y-L, Bill, yes.
Whiskey 2, Romeo, India, Alpha, Paul, no.
Good evening, all. K2KY.
So far I've heard Wesley, Bill, and I think that was Paul. Anyone else want to sign into the TechNet? Please give me your call letters, name, and the word yes at this time if you have a question or a comment.
KB1, NNH, Jerry, no.
KB1, THM, no. KC2 WYP, no.
Okay, we've picked up November, November Hotel, Tango Hotel Mike, and WYP, all with no's. Let me drop.
Before we start, KC1.
Very fine, Val. I notice that the audio is changing volume. All of a sudden, it's jumped to a much lower volume. We'll eventually figure out what's going on. You've got it, Mel. KQRIW.
Yeah, that's me on the internet. I have a question.
Okay, Joe, we're going to put you on the list. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay. Number of emails on the preface, some of the information that is coming through on about how this net is being conducted. 90% approval rate, Dick. The only thing is some of the younger people would like to get in on the discussion, and they have to get to bed. Oh, yeah, they can't stay up much after 10 o'clock. So maybe we can make for a little space for young people's space corner or whatever, and just keep that up to get the benefit of some of the information that they are seeking to get over.
Okay. Because of the extra wind we got tonight, your signal's a little bit crackly. Anything you can do to increase the power would help a little bit. Let's flip over to the mailbag, because I think the younger people who sign in with questions, some of them don't have a ham radio license yet, would like to have one, and they're sending you email with their questions and comments. So let's try to make a schedule tonight for 9:30. We'll flip over to the mailbag, and we'll do that for a certain length of time, and then we'll go into the deeper discussions later. Do you believe that would be an improvement, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, yeah, I increased the power here, but they're up to 55 watts. Yeah, I think that would be a good idea, because it seemed to have aroused quite a bit of interest what we started discussing last week about how to get into it, doing basic experiments in electronics, the encouragement to see if we can get more people interested, and hopefully, you know, the involvement in electronics will lead to more involvement in their interest in mathematics, and just general science. So I think this is a good gateway for them to start is by doing little experiments. And so I thought we could elaborate on some of it, like last week you had mentioned some basic instruments and soldering. I think we can elaborate a little bit more on that, Dick. So I think 9:30 should be a reasonable time, over.
Very fine, Mel. And by the way, the extra 55 watts sounds quite a bit better when the antenna is being waved around. It's got the cracklies on a windy night like tonight. Alrighty. So of the people who signed in with a yes, we've got Wesley and Joe, and I don't think anyone else had a yes, or maybe Mr. SYL. KC2SYL, Bill, you did have a yes. Is that true? Go ahead.
Well, this is that's affirmative. I had a yes.
Okay. So that was a yes for Bill. So I guess we're going to go then to Wesley, Bill, and Joe in that order, because that's the order in which I heard them. Okay, Wesley has been gathering quite a bit of test equipment. He calls them his toys, and it's a very good thing to call them. He's mailed me some pictures of the equipment he's gathered so far. So he's coming up with one hell of a laboratory there in Queens, and it's going to be the place to go when you want to do some elaborate testing. He's going to be doing some high voltage testing and maybe even electromagnetic interference and radio frequency biohazard. You wait and see. Lots of experiments are going to be going on. I see the beginning of good things there, Wesley. And by the way, one other person was once accused of doing junk science. I want to say a couple of words on that one, too. There is no such thing as junk science. There is no such thing as a bad question or a dumb question. A dumb question is the one which has the most amount of difference between what the person knows and what he would like to know. So our philosophy on the TechNet is that dumb questions are perfectly legal, and we don't chew people up for doing that. And the word dumb and junk science is an inappropriate word, because if you're really doing science, like Mr. Edison was doing, for the first 3,000 or so experiments, people thought he was doing junk science, because it looked like it was going to be hopeless to try to find a material that could tolerate 5,000 or 4,000 degrees centigrade and give him a light bulb. and he eventually found the material. That so-called junk science turned into a useful product. Not everything is supposed to be successful, but you learn by the process. You learn by the mistakes. There's lessons learned in every one of those. So science is science. And you're passing unfair judgment when you say this is excellent science and that's junk science. If it's done with sincerity, integrity, and it's not hurting anyone, all science is good science. So let me drop. It's a philosophy of mine that inside of every ham radio operator is a person who would like to be a scientist. He may not use those words, but he'd like to know what Mother Nature is telling him. How do these electrons and photons, and how does all this stuff work? How does that signal propagate through the ether, through the hard vacuum of space? There's a lot of mystery to be this. It does. Radio gives you action at a distance, and that's kind of exciting once you understand what's going on. The person who just goes out and buys a cell phone and uses it as a pure appliance operator, sometimes he's not appreciating how much technology there is behind that front cover of that instrument that he's bought or is renting, and how much technology there is at those cell site base stations that's maintaining all this, or the local wireless area network, wide area network, or the 802.11. There's some real good science in all of that. Okay, let's see what Wesley's got to say, and how's it going, Wesley, on collecting all the equipment, and what would you like to know, what would you like to find, what other pieces of equipment are you lacking? N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet. Wait for the beep, and don't be like me, Wesley. Look at your watch once every minute. You have to interrupt. You got it, Wesley.
Okay, at the beginning I would like to know, this is November, the X-ray Juliet November, is my audio okay?
Your audio is dead, full quieting. You got a good, clean signal. Have fun.
Okay. In the process of collecting all of the equipment, I have over 40 devices so far, and actually, from the pictures that I didn't sell you, send you a very nice vintage Variac with a meter built into the knob, and the second one is quite new frequency meter from 0.0.1 of hertz to over 1 gigahertz. Now, the question of mine is, let me drop. I was able to acquire two U.S. Army meters. One is voltmeter and the other one is multimeter, high frequency. And the last part of the pictures, you're going to see the one, the metal one, and the other one looks like a block made from Bakelite. And I'm trying to use your help in order to find out if these multimeters actually do not repeat themselves. So the first one is not the multimeter, it is a meter. TS375A/U. TS375A/U. And this one is from 1952, but actually there is the original tag on it from 1955. There is a, and it was put to the reserve of the United States Army in 1965. Just for temporary, and it is staying in this stage till now. Let me drop. Okay, now this one does have a 5 megawatt of AC resistance. And the DC resistance is 30 megaohms. The probe is actually the tube. That's the tube that is built into the probe. And it's hot. And the probe capacitance is negligible. And the input capacitance is 2.5 nanofarads, if I read it correctly, nanofarads. Okay. The probe resistance frequency, resonance frequency is 600 megahertz, approximately, and the probe input capacitance is 5 picofarads. Well, AC resistance 5 megaohms. Okay, now, this is the first one. And of course, this one has a two probes, DC and AC. Now the other one, both of them looks like new from inside, Absolutely lucky one. Completely done. Complete. And the other one is the electronic multimeter. It's not a voltmeter. The first one had the voltage from 1 to 1.5 volts, 1 to 3 volts, and 1 to 300 volts. The second one is the AN slash US Marine 116A. And this one is going in AC volts from 0 to 1000, in DC volts from 0 to 1000. The resistance is at 10 ohms, and the 0.2 microamp is the minimum voltage that could be measured with that. The resistance is 10 mega ohms. So when I mentioned that the resistance of the first one was 6 mega ohms, the other one is multimeter, has everything that I could do, resistance, the voltage and the current up to, I don't remember how much. Now what I'm trying today to find out is how these multimeters actually repeat themselves. And the one is definitely only the radio frequency application. The other one is like radio frequency application plus. Back to Dick.
Okay, my first response, I might not be on target, but I'll tell you what little I know. A very popular kind of vacuum tube voltmeter built by quite a few people, and there were military versions of it and commercial versions of it. Hewlett-Packard, among other companies, made a vacuum tube voltmeter in which there is a RF probe. In other words, there was a probe which has a tubular section near the end, which is about 3 inches long and about an inch and a quarter in diameter, and inside of there was a rectifying diode vacuum tube. And the reason for that is when you want to make RF measurements, ordinarily you would think that all you've got to do is put the vacuum tube voltmeter on the AC scale, connect one of your leads coming out of the VTVM to ground and the other one to the circuit you want to measure. And you really can't do that because that great big long piece of wire for your red probe into the VTVM would have a whole lot of stray capacitance, stray inductance to ground and whatever. The AC measurements of a vacuum tube voltmeter runs up to some number of kilohertz and maybe tens of kilohertz, and all of a sudden the leads, the capacitance and the inductance of the leads starts giving you some errors. Let me drop. So what they have invented instead is a probing device where there is a pure rectifier right at the end of this long wire, and so the actual signal being picked up only has to go through, let's say, half an inch of probe before it hits the rectifying diode. Then your RF energy is rectified into a DC voltage. The DC voltage is then passed up the coaxial cable into the meter. And the meter, although it may indicate to you what AC voltage is present on that RF probe, it's really making a DC voltage measurement. And these RF probes, some of them go up to as high as a gigahertz. But there's a catch. Although they go as high as a gigahertz, and the pure wire on the AC scale would probably only be good for 1 kilohertz or 10 kilohertz. The good news is they go up to a gigahertz, but they still create some loading of the circuit. The AC and DC resistance going into that probe is still something that's going to create some grief when you connect it. Even though the DC resistance of that probe may be many megohms, and they may tell you that the AC resistance is some significant number of megohms, if they told you, for instance, that the probe had a stray capacitance between its two clips at the end, normally on these AC probes, you've got two very short alligator clips at the end on approximately 1 inch or a half inch of wire, and one is supposed to go to the local ground and one goes to the circuit that's going to be measured. And 2.5 or 5 picofarads is maybe what would be present. By way of the normal calculation for capacitive reactance, You assume that that capacitance that's stated by the manufacturer of that probe is from the hot lead to ground, across those two clip leads, so to speak, a 5 picofarad capacitor at 1 gigahertz would have a reactance of around 34 ohms. So in other words, even though the capacitance is very low, 5 picofarads, which in the old days used to be called 5 microfarads, a millionth of a farad, so to speak, a very small amount of capacitance. But because of what happens with the capacitive loading, it is going to give you a 34 ohm capacitive reactance, and on many circuits, that might be a 50 ohm circuit, and you add a 34 ohm capacitive reactance to ground, it's going to disturb the circuit. You have a similar problem with 10 to 1 scope probes that go into an oscilloscope. The oscilloscope may be rated, particularly a sampling oscilloscope, would go up to frequencies like this. However, the scope probe itself has some number of picofarads that by way of the normal formula, 1 over 2 pi FC, frequency and capacitance, hertz and farads respectively, you calculate that, and as I said, 5 picofarads, it's going to be around 34 ohms. There are ways around that. Let me drop. As long as the circuit you're measuring has a big enough voltage that you can sacrifice some of that voltage, I have on occasion decided that I'm measuring a 50 ohm circuit, and if I put a 10,000 ohm load on the circuit, that would have very little disturbance of the circuit. So I have on occasion put a 10,000 ohm resistor at the tip of an oscilloscope probe, a times 10 to 1 oscilloscope probe, in order to get rid of the capacitive reactance of the probe itself. As long as I choose a good design of a small, let's say, a carbon composition resistor that really has 10,000 ohms of resistance, and if I choose one that's small enough, it could have an extremely small amount of capacitance, maybe a tenth of a picofarad and maybe considerably smaller than that, I can stop the circuit from being an excessive load to the measurement I want to make, and then I can calibrate that system. I have disturbed the normal calibration of the oscilloscope probe, but there's various ways by which I can connect a signal generator through that network, find out what is the new transfer coefficient at each frequency, and therefore calibrate the readings I get on the screen. So there are various techniques to go step by step to higher and higher frequencies and still make measurements, using 50-ohm instrumentation like a vector network analyzer or a 50-ohm oscilloscope is one approach. But if you don't want to disturb the circuit and you want to do probing, the RF probe is good to certain frequencies, but there are ways you can go beyond that if you're smart enough, and that's one of the many techniques that you can use that I just described to you. Maybe that helps a little bit, Wesley. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet. Yeah, stand by, Wesley, and see what Mel's got. I'll bet you found some crafty ways of getting rid of the stray capacitance of a probe when you wanted to probe an RF circuit. K2KEY, K2RIW. Go ahead, Mel.
This is the...
They made some nice instruments years ago. They may be somewhat antique today, but if you can find them, I have one. I have an RF VTVM that was made by Booten. Now, if you remember Booten Instruments, they were pretty popular. I don't think they ever made anything solid state. There was certainly a food business similar to Hewlett Packard at the time. I think they were successful for a while, Hewlett Packard and Fat Booten. And they had this nice meter, ACV-TVM. The probe had a shield. It was a shielded wire to the probe. The probe was marked demodulator. It was a demodulator probe. And the meter and everything was calibrated for that probe. I still use it occasionally. They gave you a chart, you know, with what to really expect, you know, when you're reading how to compensate and whatnot. But it's good to about at least 500 megs, Dick. And if you find something like that, many times you can buy it for just a few bucks. Over.
That built-in demodulator probe, which really is similar to the vacuum tube voltmeter RF probe, I think it's just a different name for a very similar function, and it went to 500 megacycles. Do you remember roughly how many picofarad of stray capacitance it had? I think on certain circuits that would still create some loading. If you can get the stray capacitance of the demodulator well below 1 picofarad, you start entering the realm where it gives less and less disturbance, like detuning, of the circuit you're measuring. I wonder if you happen to know how many picofarads that demodulator probe claimed to have, Mel. Back to you, Mel.
I don't know. I haven't looked at the probe in a long time. Now that they've picked up the instrument, still every so often it does have use. The probe is humongous, to say the least. Well, let's put it this way. Do you remember the old Bethesda probes that Tektronix used to produce for, like, their, get back in the 50s or 60s for their Bolton and all? You remember the gray probe with that shielded thing in your hand? And then a long plastic tip with a tip, because things were big in those days. Soldering irons to solder your components. So these big probes and all, they work. And you know, the probe is shielded. It's well shielded, and it's a handful of tick over.
Quite a bit of noise on your signal, so I'll repeat what Mel was saying, and that is the probes in the early days, Tektronix among other brands, used to be very large devices. An ordinary scope probe in, let's say, 1965, was something of probably 7 or 8 inches long. The more modern probes are much, much smaller, and they've also gotten smaller in the amount of stray capacitance they create. There's also some huge, great big probes that are a foot or two long when they're supposed to, it looks like a lance if you were going to be doing jousting, almost a sword-like thing, but it's round, when you're making extremely high voltage measurements, like 30,000 volts. So, by various techniques, there are ways you can decouple your sensing device from the measurement you're trying to make. One of the really funny things that I've seen, when you look at the circuits that are recommended for measurements at, say, for instance, 90 gigahertz, and you'll see these periodically in Microwave Theory and Techniques Journal, the monthly journal of the MTT Society of the IEEE. What they will sometimes do is give up with probing entirely. They simply know that the way the circuit is laid out, they either intentionally create a very small antenna, or they know that the microstrip that they're using is going to have a certain degree of radiation of a signal. It'll literally transmit a signal into space, and either 3 inches or 1 foot away, they'll put a horn to pick up that signal and then measure it into something like a spectrum analyzer. Measure the amount of radiated signal and know that if 10% of the signal is being radiated, which is a 10 decibel decrease from the real signal strength that's present, then you can easily calibrate what you see on the screen and know that what's really going on in your circuit is 10 dB stronger than that. So there are times when no real probing takes place at all. You let Mother Nature couple that signal through the air into your probing network. And they do that at 94 gigs. So,
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Step by step, as you're about to find out, Wesley, there's a zillion ways of doing probing at high frequencies and high voltages so that you do very little disturbance. You always have a little bit of the, what some people erroneously call the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. When you put a probe in there to make a measurement, you're usually disturbing the circuit. But the amount of disturbance, there are crafty ways of decreasing it, and there are crafty ways of re-evaluating what would the real value have been before the disturbance. So you can evaluate the amount of disturbance, you can minimize the amount of disturbance, you can evaluate the amount, you can recalibrate the whole system. There's lots and lots of ways of doing it. You'd be amazed how many crafty techniques the ham radio operators have found. One of these times I'll describe the so-called New England technique for making leakage measurements. N2XJN, K2RIW on the TechNet. Over to you, Wesley.
Okay, Antrax CN. Well, Peter, you have a picture that I sent you, the last email that I have sent you. Quite impressively looking, an absolute beauty. And when you touch this piece of equipment, you actually feel that history, and you feel that craftsmanship, the American craftsmanship. Not the Japanese, and not the Chinese, it's the American made. And all of this care that they put into doing that. Well, they also had to fulfill the requirement of the army, and that is actually very much reflected in the manuals. Now, the two pieces of equipment that I don't have as of yet is the Gauss meter and the permeability meter. Well, let's say you have a magnet. And how strong is the magnet? How can you measure the magnet strength? And then, there are various techniques to actually measure that you can do it, or you can buy the special meter for it, but it is very expensive. Even more expensive is the meter that is able to measure the permeability of the ferrites. And the higher the permeability, the lower the frequency that could work with it. In other words, is that the frequency that's supposed to be suppressed in order to do not create self-oscillation of the circuit. Back to you, Dick, and to XGS.
Now, I personally have used a Gauss meter. It was way back in the 70s. And the particular Gauss meter I had, the actual probing device, was a Hall effect device. You can buy integrated circuits these days that are not very expensive, that are a Hall effect device. The Hall effect device, from one point of view, is a little bit like a field effect transistor. There's a resistive bar where a current is put across the resistive bar from the bottom end to the top end, so to speak, of this bar. And there are two voltage sensing circuits on the left and right side. When that Hall effect device is exposed to a magnetic field, the electrons flowing through the bar become deflected to the left or to the right, depending on whether or not it's being brought near a north pole magnet or a south pole of a magnet. So you could buy a Gauss meter, and some of them are not very expensive, some of them are extremely expensive, depending on the degree of accuracy and the calibration requirement. And by the way, a Hall effect device, the nice thing about it, let me drop, is that it can make a steady state measurement of a magnetic field. A ordinary fixed magnet, you can measure the strength of the magnetic field by bringing a Hall effect device near the poles of that magnet. And so, and some of these Hall effect devices work at reasonably high frequencies. So even if it is an electromagnet with an AC signal going to it, the right kind of a Hall effect device would allow you to see the magnetic field going positive, negative, and the exact waveform for some of these Hall effect devices. So one approach is to buy a Gauss meter. And many of the Gauss meters work on only AC, but the really good ones work on DC. And when it comes to the clamp-on ammeters, many of them, the DC circuit of a clamp-on ammeter, the kind that works down at DC, really contains a Hall effect device. So a crafty amateur, if he wanted to spend the time, could buy the right kind of Hall effect device, some of them are not very expensive, and build his own probe that then he plugs into either his oscilloscope or his vacuum tube voltmeter or many other kinds of instrumentation to see what's coming out. And therefore you could measure steady state magnetic field and varying magnetic field. And when it comes to engineering understanding of magnetic circuits, my goodness, there's a big hole in the knowledge in that area. Let me drop. Let's see let me break in and let's see what Eric, if you've got to measure a magnetic field, I bet you've used Hall effect devices. How do you do it? A little bit of noise on your signal, but you sound good. You got it, Eric.
All right, Dick. National Semiconductor and Maxim make Hall effect devices. They have, both of them have application note sheets. They show you exactly how to calibrate them too. It'll give you sample circuits. We in the CO use all fixed all the time on VTRs. And I actually own a gas meter, and one that I actually built for doing some high-frequency magnetic field work. So there are quite a few devices out there that cost about $1 a piece. They're not expensive. And for the application notes, you can build yourself a well-calibrated device, Dick.
So would you recommend that Wesley go to National Semiconductor, Hall Effect, Google that word combination? Will he find a website that gives him application notes on and specific Hall Effect devices with application notes that will help him build the probe that would keep him very happy? Is that one of the best recommendations you would suggest for him, Eric? Go ahead.
Go to nationalsemi.com. All the manufacturers have their application notes. All you're going to do is search their website. You'll find them. I think even Freescale has them, so you can go to freescale.com. I know Maxim has them, which is now DallasMaxim.com, or just Maxim.com. I look at the various different devices, and they have multiple Hall Effect devices. They have sensing Hall Effect devices. They have Hall Effect devices that give you an absolute measurement at a specific distance.
Okay, sounds like somebody has supplied quite a bit of information without a whole lot of dollars if you're willing to build your own probe. That sounds like a fairly crafty way to go, and it's a good experiment for an enthusiastic amateur. However, the second half of Wesley's question is a little more troublesome. If you want to measure the permeability of an unknown ferrite or iron...
application note how to do that, too.
Okay, tell me about that. So I think you're saying these Hall Effect devices, which are measuring local magnetic fields, properly used, will also allow you to measure permeability of unknown material. Back to you, Eric.
Yeah, you can think of it as if you were using a network analyzer, where you have a source, and you couple that source to the unknown ferrite material, and you have a calibrated Hall Effect device on the other end, or across it, and logarithmic amplifier, I believe, if I remember correctly, and that gives you an actual permeability number.
So I think you're saying now if he looks at Hall Effect devices and the application notes from National Semiconductor, Freescale, and Maxim, M-A-X-I-M, three very good companies, I think you're saying he's going to find ways of setting up Hall Effect devices for measuring specific measurements of steady state and varying magnetic fields, and step by step he will then get into measurement of the permeability of the material. Now the simple solution is to go out and buy material where the manufacturer has told you that this material has a mu of 20 and it's good up to 150 megacycles. That's one approach. But if you have an unknown material because somebody is giving you a whole junk box full of things, some of them are toroids with no markings on them, and you want to find out what they are, I think you're saying step by step by the use of these application notes on Hall Effect devices and a signal generator into a number of turns of wire on the unknown ferrite, I think you're saying a person could come up with a pretty good approximation. And when you're measuring the mu of permeability of a material, if the real permeability is 47 and you measure 53, from my point of view, that's good enough. And if you measure that it's got this amount of lost tangent at 150 megacycles, that's good enough. I mean, most of what we amateurs do doesn't have to be traceable to the Bureau of Standards and have 0.01% accuracy. Am I somewhat right on these application notes would allow him to measure permeability? KE2EJ, K2RIW, you got it, Eric.
Yeah, if I was sitting in front of my computer, I could tell you exactly, but I'm not, unfortunately. It's been a while since I've had a need to go looking for that stuff, because there was a time that I was investigating materials used for a guitar pickup, and that was one of the things that I came across, so. I don't remember who exactly had it, but I came across one. It's a little setup that you could use, and it's different for each type of form. You know, there's one for bar, one for toy, because the method of measurement is slightly different when you have a closed loop than you have an open piece of material. I think it was about 5-6 years ago. So, yeah, you're going to have to dig for that, but you should be able to find it somewhere.
Eric, let me put a string around one of your fingers, and that is, if you happen to come across that application note, that would help Wesley be able to measure the permeability of an unknown ferrite material. If you happen to run across that application note, and if you can pass it to him, me, or whoever, I think you'd appreciate that. Be willing to accept that challenge. Don't spend a whole lot of time on it, but if you happen to run into it, I think he would appreciate it. Back to you, Eric.
I know where to find it.
Eric first, and then Mel in that order. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, no problem. I'm actually heading up to the repeater site to whack a computer up there, which I had no intention of doing, but I'm going to do that anyway. But when I get back a little later, I'll take a look through my drawer of notes, and I'll probably have it in there somewhere.
Yeah, this could be an excellent subject for the technical net, because if I probe all of the electrical engineers I run into on a daily basis, and I ask them, could you design a power transformer? Except for Glenn, KC2QIQ, I think almost every one of the engineers I come across could not do that. Yes, they could do it as a trial and error process. They would try a certain number of turns and would find out what happens and then try changing it to try to make it better. But very few of us.
Dell's website.
Say that again?
Go to Peter Dell's website. He's got this whole thing there about how to make a transformer.
Yeah, Peter Dowell, I think, is the guy who makes these hyper-sill transformers for high-power amplifiers. I mean, if you're running a kilowatt single sideband amplifier and you want one of those Peter Dowell beautiful transformers, I think you're saying he has a website that helps you do that design. Is that what you're saying, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's been a few years since I've looked at it. But, yeah, there's a website that's pretty good, too. That goes through the design process. But then again, I also have the Electrical Engineer's Handbook from like 1945, and they also have all the formulas in there, how to figure out the core, how to do the distance, how to calculate how tight the wrap is, how to space the windings. I mean, it's not an unknown science. It's too well documented if you know where to look for it.
Very good. Now, on a quick break, tell us how to spell the word Dowell. Peter Dowell. How do you spell that word if you happen to remember, Eric? Go ahead.
It's not Dowell. It's D-A-H-A-L, I forget.
Okay, something like D-A-H-L or D-A-H-A-L. Is that what you said?
D-A-H-A-L, I think it is.
Okay, now, Mel wants to give us some information. I bet you you've measured the permeability of various things when you were building all those exotic filters in the past, Mel. K2KEY, wait for the beep. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Ran into that situation, like you say, getting a box full of toroids and all kinds of things and all. I was, you know, making a lot of different types of circuits and all, using for RTTY filters, and then I get into the audio filters using toroids and things of that sort. And there was a very neat article that was in Ham Radio Magazine. I guess you could just, look up Ham, get back. I think they have it online now. You can get back issues or back articles. And it was on the measurement, how to measure toroids, permeability of toroids. In other words, they give you a way of measuring, and then you have to get a chart from either Palomar or the other one of those companies. And they'll tell you exactly what the mix is. But it's a very neat way to test. Very simple gadget to make up, Dick. It's just a gadget that you put together, very simple. Now, as far as transformers go, yeah, as Eric said, very neat book I have also on transformers. And I used that. I converted one time. I took a transformer from a Dumont television set, which was a big transformer. Let me let it drop. And what I did is I reworked the transformer. I took off, got rid of the filament windings on it. I got rid of, the 5-volt filament winding for the rectifier, and then I got took off the 6.3 volts, and I rewound the secondary, and I made myself a plate transformer that gave me 1,200 volts. And it was very explicit how to go about it. They give you everything, how to figure the dimensions, type dimensions of the E laminations and all that. So all that information is available, Dick. You just got to look in the right place. But for measuring permeability, this is a neat little gadget that I have that you put together. And it works extremely well. It's so accurate that if you take a core that is known, that you buy a core that's known, and put it in it, it tells you exactly the same reading. Over.
Very well. I can tell this is a person trying to give us information, but either he doesn't have enough signal strength or enough PL tone. And let me take a quick check here. I just checked that if you don't have PL tone, the repeater is set in a mode where you won't get through. So if a person with either not enough RF or not enough PL, I only hear a fraction of, Eric's going to change that, but up till now I've only heard a fraction of a syllable of a person who's trying to break in and give us some information, and he hasn't been making it, so maybe he will make it after Eric makes the change. When it comes to past issues of Ham Radio Magazine and QST Magazine, both of those are archived at ARRL. If you are a ARRL member, you can sign in, go to their archives, and I think almost all of the issues of Ham Radio Magazine are archived. You can go back to those past articles, and they go back many years on the majority of the articles in QST Magazine, and also product reviews. So there's a wealth of information there. I believe there's one or two other websites which will allow you to look at the archives of Ham Radio. It's too bad that Ham Radio Magazine is no longer in existence, but there were some extremely good articles in there, very crafty articles from time to time. Let me drop.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I'm hearing you now. Tell us who you are and what your information is, sir. KQRIW, my name is Dick.
Okay, Dick, I just changed the frequency to seldom. Can you read me any better?
We're reading you very well, and you're about to tell us who you are. I've got a strong guess, but go ahead and tell us who you are.
W-T-E-W-K. Dick, I told you a long time ago, I have the book. It tells you all about transformers and that stuff, the O-R-C-A book. You want it for free? I give it for free. I don't want the book.
Okay, that's an attractive offer. Eugene, W-2-E-W-K, Whiskey 2 Echo Whiskey Kilowatt, has the RCA book on transformer design. He's offering it free of charge. And there's a chance that Wesley, N2XJN, is going to take him up on that. So, and we'll eventually find out, if I know Bell, there's a chance that he's eventually going to find out which issue of Ham Radio Magazine, because he's got almost all of them, has this article allowing you to measure the permeability of unknown ferrite materials. He's eventually going to be telling us that. I know the way he operates. And with any further questions or comments along these lines, give us a little bit of a break, and then Wesley pick up. With a little bit of a delay, Wesley to take it, N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Wesley.
Okay, well, one of the solutions to get a hail, what was that? You gotta teach me how to pronounce it properly. Hall effect. Oh, I've got it. Hall effect. The flux meter that uses the sensor, hall sensor from CD-ROM, motor assembly, and you can probably get it from the jungle equipment, or you can get it for, and there are three sensors in the new motor. This motor goes for $4, and you can actually check the north and south orientation of the magnets, identify and count poles in plastic or ring magnet, check the relative strength of permanent magnets, and determine if the stator is wired. How was that? Oh, there was a Y or delta. Yeah. And this operates 1.5 volts only. So the typical small AA battery could do it. So there was one of us that I was trying to do. I was thinking that I'm going to go for it because if I disassemble one motor and carefully unsolder these four legs of SSF, that's how it's that cheap mark that I would be able to have it. Well, the problem that I have is when I'm dealing with neodymium magnets, then permeability, the strength of the magnet is mostly too high for the typical measurement devices that are available within the range of 0 to 200 dollars to be measured. Well, I thought that it might be another solution for that. I put a finger or something that is a distance between the magnet and the sensor.
Repeater, time out.
Yeah, unfortunately, the last 30 seconds got timed out there, Wesley, and it may not be your fault. We maybe didn't drop long enough in between. But it sounds like Wesley is interested in the book that Eugene is offering, Whiskey 2 Echo Whiskey Kilowatt, W2EWK, Eugene, is offering this RCA book. When it comes to a neodymium magnet being too strong for the Hall effect devices, that's the lesser of many evils. Let me drop.
Eric?
Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, you can use a calibrated thickness of mu metal as an attenuator.
Beautiful. Wesley was saying, I was listening to him on the input, is that he was going to put his finger or some other material in there. As long as you know the shape of the neodymium magnet, in other words, where is it north and its south pole, so to speak, it is quite predictable, not perfectly predictable, but quite predictable, how fast that magnetic field will fall off with extra distance. That's one approach. The other approach that Eric would use is to take a standard sheet of mu metal material. Mu metal material is metal that many people use as a shielding material around a transformer, for instance. It's a material that conducts magnetic field so well that a thin sheet of it wrapped around a transformer will stop the external magnetic field around a transformer, and therefore the coupling, the hum coupling it does into adjacent sensitive circuits is drastically decreased. So a known thickness of mu metal material is a kind of magnetic attenuator. That's an approach. So distance is one approach, and mu metal shielding material is another approach, and there's probably a third approach. So when the signal you want to measure is too strong, that's the lesser of many evils. The majority of time somebody wants to make a measurement, the signal you want to measure is so weak that your sensitivity of your instrumentation is not good enough. But to overload the instrumentation, my goodness, there's lots and lots of ways of doing that one. And even the Hall effect device itself, let me think. Change the voltage across it. That's not it. Hall, by the way, is H-A-L-L. It's pronounced just like the hall of your house. So Mr. Hall invented this technique, and it's a beautiful way of making DC and AC magnetic field measurements. Anyone want to add anything to this? Give me a call. That is right now. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Dick, you want to get out my phone number?
If you're willing to do it, go right ahead, Eugene. Eugene's going to give us the phone number where that RCA book on how to design transformers is available. It's probably a slightly older book, maybe a little bit on the large size, but the price is right. Go right ahead, Eugene. Give us your phone number.
Okay, the phone number is L-475-1987. L-475-1987. To the first person comes to my desk, that's we'll get the free RCA book. And it is about 1 foot. It's 1 foot. And a lot of schematics. So you will have fun. Give me a call right before you come. And the book is free. F-R-E-E. For the taken. W-T-E-W-K.
I didn't catch it. I got only 475198. Dick?
Yeah, I'm going to repeat that for you. It's area 617. It turns out, Eugene, you're talking a little bit too loud through the eastern input, and therefore the machine is chopping you out. It's area 6. It's the Suffolk County area. All of a sudden, my mind's going blank. You guys know who that is. The Suffolk County area. 618, is it? All of a sudden, I can't think of it, but it's 475.
21.
Say that again.
631.
631.
Yeah, 631-475-1987. The first person who offered to take that book, who's got the real question, is Eugene, N2XJN. So hold on a little bit there, Eugene, and let Wesley take first crack at that book. He seems to be the guy who's putting forth the most amount of effort these days to set up this laboratory, and he wants to know that information. Is that agreed, Eugene? Go ahead and talk a little bit lower.
Okay, QSL. It's area code 631-475-1987. Okay, we're agreed to it. As soon as you give me a call, we'll make arrangements. Any time is best to call. Well, here goes the phone mail. See that? We got Bullseye, W2WK.
And if that's Wesley, you guys have already got a closed deal. Wesley, you already on the phone with him?
No, not yet, because I respect the TechNet very much. As you see, I'm not missing even one TechNet for a long period of time since I discovered it. 631-475-1987, I'm going to call the gentleman. And also, Dick, if you could put on the paper my telephone number, because I have something to deliver to you, and... I'm not having a chance. It's 718-717-7600. Again, 718-717-7600. Back to you.
Welcome to the W2VL repeater.
Very fine, Wesley. Got your phone number. And right now I'm going through a fairly busy period where my main client, my main consulting client, is demanding more and more of my time. They're going through a critical development project. So I'll warn you ahead of time, I don't have a lot of spare time right now. Okay, hopefully you and Eugene will hook up. I think Eugene recognizes the fact that you're essentially the first person that called because you called over the TechNet. So although someone else may have gotten to the phone first. Good luck with those projects of measuring magnetic field, measuring permeability, measuring high-frequency voltages without loading down the circuit. There's a whole learning curve on properly using instrumentation for making measurements. That's an awful lot of what an engineer has to learn when he comes out of school. Let me drop.
I got the information on the permeability meter.
Fantastic. Tell us what issue of Ham Radio Magazine had it. I knew you would find it. I could hear it happening. Over to you, Mel.
I looked it up. Toroid and permeability meter. June, Ham Radio, June 1977, page 46, over.
Fantastic. I'm going to repeat that. So page 46, 1977, June issue, Ham Radio Magazine. Toroid and permeability measurements. And so quite possibly that article is going to be in the archive at ARRL. And so an ARRL member probably has access to them. If not, there's other ways. I know that Mel would be able to maybe scan that article and send it, but that's the last resort. Let's see if we can get it electronically first. Good luck with those projects, Wesley. We're setting up quite a laboratory. Looks like pretty soon we're going to be going to you to make our measurements. Let me go on to the next person now, who was Bill, KC2SYL. Bill, what would you like to ask the TechNet tonight, K2RIW on the TechNet?
To the net, this is Bill, KC2SYL. I have a question about a helical antenna for monitoring and possibly communicating with satellites. Back to net.
Okay, so you said a blank antenna, I missed that word, to communicate and monitor satellites. And I presume you're talking about ham radio satellites like the Oscar series although quite possibly you're also talking about the geosynchronous satellites that are doing electronic transfer of data, like broadcast and whatever. So what's the name of that antenna? Your signal is a little bit noisy, Bill. Anything you can do to increase the power or aim the antenna a little bit, it might help. I'll listen on both the input and the output.